All right, first matter on calendar this morning, docket number 88095, Smith v. State. Counsel, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay, do you want to reserve any time?
I would.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Curry-Diamond, and I represent Sophia Smith in the matter before this court. Your Honors, her cases should be dismissed because the state acted either in bad faith or intentionally delayed prosecution to gain a tactical advantage that resulted in actual non-speculative prejudice to Ms. Smith. Alternatively, if Ms. Smith is just entitled to a new trial, she is entitled to a new trial because of an incorrect jury instruction which eliminated the state's burden of proof. Additionally, she currently stands convicted of 5 counts of elder exploitation in violation of unit of prosecution. And finally, at least 2 counts could not have been tried because they fell outside of the statute of limitations. First, to the pre-indictment delay issue, Ms. Smith had to prove that she had suffered actual non-speculative prejudice from a delay, and that the prosecution intentionally delayed bringing charges in order to gain a tactical advantage over the accused, or that the prosecution was delayed in bad faith. This court has never defined what bad faith is, but if we look to what a general definition would be, it's that an intentional dishonest act by not fulfilling a legal or contractual obligation. Elder exploitation is unique in that NRS 200.50955 requires a law enforcement agency to promptly seek and obtain warrants of arrest for any person that the agency has probable cause to believe committed exploitation of an older or vulnerable person. So as soon as probable cause was established in this case, which was November 30th when Detective Vukanovich signed the arrest warrant, she had to act promptly in order to execute that arrest warrant and ensure Mr. Hoffman's protection. So Detective Vukanovich's actions in this case were at minimum bad faith. Additionally, there was a strong tactical advantage that occurred when the prosecution was delayed. The police were initially contacted in May. Detective Vukanovich then has contact with Jim and Charles during the course of several months. In August, they file a petition for probate, and then the civil case starts to unfold. Detective Vukanovich then, as I said, has probable cause on November 30th, but the civil case continues to unfold, and she never files for that arrest warrant. During the civil case, she's in contact with Jim and Charles, and Jim and Charles are seeking for requests for admissions, interrogatories, depositions are taken. So Ms. Smith's actions, a stipulation in order, ultimately result. So Ms. Smith is defending the civil case.
Was Ms. Smith aware of the criminal investigation at that time?
No, Ms. Smith had been contacted by Detective Vukanovich over the police report that she and Mr. Hoffman's filed against Jim and Charles. So, and there was no pending criminal action, so Ms. Smith couldn't ask for a stay in the civil proceeding. Had there been a criminal action that had been filed and she knew about it, she could have sought a stay so that the civil case would not have continued.
Now, counsel, there's no evidence in the record that the state is in any way directing the civil litigation or directing the plaintiffs in that or petitioners in that litigation, correct?
Correct.
So your issue is that they just kind of stood by while that unfolded?
Yes, and I think that also when we look at this court's decision in State versus Autry, right, the intentional delay and tactical advantage can also be, you know, a reckless disregard for the appreciable risks of how it's going to affect the defendant's case, right? And I think that at minimum has been met here, right? There's a reckless disregard where how the civil action is going to unfold and how it's going to damage Ms. Smith's case and her ability to defend herself in the criminal action, especially when we take that in conjunction with the fact that Mr. Hoffman's has dementia and is deteriorating. And then by the time of trial, he has already been found to not have testamentary capacity, and he has been found to be unavailable at the time of trial.
Well, so that happened before trial. I mean, substantially before trial, right?
So the stipulation and order came in June of 2022, mm-hmm. And that's when he was found to have non-testamentary capacity, and then he was called to testify at the grand jury in October of 22, and then the trial occurred. And that's part of the reason, that's part of the issue with the delay, because the state delayed 7 months before filing the criminal complaint and 11 months before filing the finding the indictment. Mr. Hoffman's, who is the only witness, exculpatory witness for Ms. Smith, his mental capacity has been deteriorating this entire time, which obviously impacted her ability to defend her case.
But from the very beginning of this, from the civil aspect on, that was the whole point. His mental capacity was in question.
Yes, well, that's what Dr. Brown found, yes. But there were two other experts in the civil case that found the opposite of that. And that's what Mr. Levitt testifies to at trial as well. Okay. So, Your Honors, moving on to the jury instruction. The jury instruction at issue in this case is jury instruction 30, where there is a presumption of undue influence. So jury instruction 30 begins with a presumption of undue influence arises when a fiduciary relationship exists and when the fiduciary benefits from a question transaction, and that that the fiduciary relationship arises from the existence of the marriage or the or a domestic partnership. The instruction goes on to quote NRS 155097, which comes out of the Wills and Estates and Deceased Persons chapter, and the instruction states a presumption of influence also applies when there's a transfer between the transferee and they benefit and they create the document and so on and so forth. So first, this instruction is incredibly problematic because these are standards from a civil case. There's been no statute that allows for these standards to apply in this criminal case. There's been no case law that allows for these standards to apply in a criminal case. There's just nothing that deems them appropriate to apply in this criminal case. Second, the instruction as given to the jury is actually a misstatement of the law in Nevada for the cases that it actually does apply to. So the instruction, both instructions have a rebuttable presumption in the civil realm, and that rebuttable presumption was excluded from the instruction that was given to the jury. So even if Ms. Smith, you know, agreed to this instruction, and which they didn't have an objection, but the instruction on its face is error. This is not even an appropriate instruction in a civil case for probate matters. So obviously the error in this is plain because it just isn't an accurate statement of the law. But finally, this is also problematic because it completely eliminates the burden of proof for the state. All the state had to show was that there was a domestic relationship. Once the state showed that, they told the jury that they could presume undue influence, which is an essential element of elder exploitation. So it completely eliminated their burden, and it affected her substantial rights significantly because Ms. Smith was only convicted of the counts for which the presumption applied to. She was found not guilty of all the other counts that the presumption did not apply to.
So, counsel, I think it's well briefed in that area, and I understand your argument. And there's only so much time.
Yes.
Okay. So unless my colleagues have a question on that area, just can we start hitting the other?
Yes. Points? Is there something you'd like me to speak about?
Unit of prosecution, if you could start there and then,
yes, of
and
course.
Then finish the rest of them.
So if this court finds that she's entitled to a new trial, Your Honors would have to resolve whether or not there's a unit of prosecution issue here. Obviously, when we look to the court's decisions in Castaneda, Figueroa, Beltran, the use of the word any kind of creates an ambiguity. However, but when we look to this court's decision in Shue versus State, the court was very clear that when the crime is against a person, the unit is the person. So when the object of the offense is used in singular terms, then it necessarily does not contemplate the plural, and therefore it's one charge per victim. And we see that in other states as well, in State versus Ramirez, State versus Graham, State versus Lynch, New Mexico, Washington, all of those places as well. Here, the statute clearly delineates that this is an older person. Now, where a conflict comes in, or at least where the state believes a conflict comes in, is with the 200.5099, which is the penalty statute. However, that statute doesn't is not a comment on the unit of prosecution, and it doesn't permit for prosecutorial discretion in this case, or in any case of elder exploitation. What that statute allows is for the court to aggregate and combine offenses in, or combine courses of conduct in order to impose punishment, because it specifically says for the purposes of imposing punishment. That's purely a judicial function. The plain language of the, the plain language of the statute very clearly is a directive to the court and not a comment on prosecutorial discretion.
Now, could the state have, in your estimation, charged with one count of exploitation and individual theft counts for each one of the offenses?
I think so, Your Honor, because the theft is a different, it's a different statute, obviously. So theft has the specific language that allows for an individual taking to be charged or a course of conduct or scheme to be charged. But when we're looking at, and that's another thing that the state raised, is that it's more similar to theft. But when we're looking at theft and elder exploitation, theft is a property crime and elder exploitation is a person crime. And so when we're looking at the cases in the progeny that talk about person crimes, Reimer and Senna, which is a child abuse, Shu versus State, these are person crimes that are focusing on the unit on the person, and that therefore it's one charge per person. I'd like to do you have any more questions? Okay. I'd like to reserve the remaining for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Austin Beaumont, and I'm here representing the state of Nevada in Sophia Smith versus State of Nevada. I'd like to respond to the units of prosecution issue first. The active language in the statute of 59.9 is that the state may aggregate separate counts into a singular count, which indicates that we have the discretion to do so, not that we are required to do so. Each of these individual acts, and we would take issue with the notion that elder exploitation is a crime against a person, it is about obtaining money. And each one of these acts to obtain money is a separate felony under our statutes. We had originally charged Ms. Smith with 28 different actions. We ultimately chose to charge those actions in groups of years. This happened over 6 years. Each one of the takings that she made from Mr. Hoffman's is in and of itself a separate felony. But rather than charge for each an individual transaction where she would have resulted in 28 B felony elder exploitation counts, she only faces 6 in this case. So our choice to aggregate these counts per year actually inures to her benefit. And in other exploitation cases, unfortunately, there's only so many ways you can commit certain crimes, and so units of prosecution make a little bit more sense.
Counsel, do you think you could have charged individual elder abuse counts for each one, each individual theft?
In this individual case, yes. Under these facts, yes.
And what would guide your ability to aggregate?
The ability to aggregate would be prosecutorial discretion based upon the facts of how each of these thefts occurred and how they were made over time.
So if it occurred over a week and every day the individual did it, you could say we could do 7. Separate.
It would depend upon the facts of that specific case. Going back to what I had said earlier, these types of thefts are very different in how they are accomplished. They can be accomplished by a simple check writing. They can be accomplished by getting into someone's bank account and sending out Zelles. They can be accomplished by wire transfer. They can be accomplished by a number of different ways. So because there's so many different ways and so many different factual situations surrounding each and every individual count, there are circumstances in which each individual taking could be considered a separate theft and that we would charge them separately.
Mr. Beaumont, how do you distinguish this case from Reimer, I'm not really sure, and Senna?
So as far as this case goes, for Reimer and Senna, what we're looking at here are a number of different acts aggregated over time. This isn't something where an exploitation begins and then it's just an ongoing pattern of behavior. It's not, for instance, like child abuse where it's an ongoing act. Each and every individual act is its own actus reus amongst the taking for that individual taking.
But isn't it more likened to a course of conduct?
Not in this case, I would argue. The course of conduct is restarted every time that Ms. Smith went back to Mr. Hoffman's for money under new and different circumstances. Each one of these takings was made under different representations, misrepresentations, different ways and patterns of deception to Mr. Hoffman's. Ultimately, she was deceiving him throughout this entire time, but each individual act was made by another series of false statements and false acts to get him to relinquish that money to her.
But can't child abuse be similar to that? The acts can be varied and different, and you're still limited to one count.
It is, again, dependent upon the facts. This is different from child abuse in that an exploitive act, taking of money, can happen once and then not happen again, and then it can go under a completely different set of circumstances in the future where that person is exploited again, but again under very different facts and circumstances. So,
but isn't this also under, you know, the false sense that there's going to be this ongoing relationship and it's going to turn romantic, and isn't that the theme underlying this whole course of conduct?
That was part of the reason. The reasons that Mr. Hoffman's gave Ms. Smith money on any individual occasion were based upon those individual occasions, part of which came out of the strong arm charity that she created. Some of these ideas of giving her money were to go to real estate school. Some of these ideas of giving her money were to pay for legal expenses. Some of these ideas for money were given for a number of different facts. So there was an undercurrent that there was some sort of relationship there, but that was not the driving force behind the entirety of these acts.
So from a policy perspective, why doesn't it make more sense that each of those individual counts could be charged as a theft, but the exploitation would attach to the person and allow for one charge per individual?
I don't think that the theft and the exploitation are charged differently in this case, and in this case we charge them exactly the same. Each exploitation count came with an accompanying theft count, because the acts are all the same as far as the taking of the money through deception or material misrepresentation. Those ideas crossed over into the different crimes, and that's why we had, in this case and in many others, an exploitation charge accompanied by a theft charge. The theft charge makes it clear that we may aggregate these by specific transaction, and the language of 59.9 allows us also that we may aggregate these, but we are not required to. So based on the interplay between exploitation and theft, we would say that these are able to be aggregated but not required to be aggregated.
So, counsel, can you address also the propriety of the res geste admission of the admission of the charitable evidence under res geste, as well as the statute of limitations issue with regard to crimes committed in secret?
Of course. So the res geste issue regarding the strong arm charity, we received information on the strong arm charity after charges had been filed, once we had done more research into the case and where some of this money was going. And once we got this information, what we found out was that from the very beginning, the act of the deception of Mr. Hoffman's started from the day that they met. And that use of the strong arm charity throughout their relationship created a trust in Mr. Hoffman's for Ms. Smith, that she was doing the right thing with the money that he was giving her, both for that charity and for her personally, because gifts to her personally were also based upon the fact that she was running this charity, and so he believed her to be a trustworthy person. We could not really address how Ms. Smith had began deceiving Mr. Hoffman's from the very beginning and throughout the relationship connected with this charity, were we not able to show that this charity was not what she was telling Mr. Hoffman's it was, nor what she was holding it out to the rest of the world to be. Additionally, he gave, if I remember correctly, 63.9% of the total money given to that charity over time. She had a website where she listed everyone out and how much money they were giving them. She conspicuously left him off of that website because that was holding out to the world that Mr. Hoffman's was giving her a great deal of money, and she wanted to take that notion away from anyone else, which went back into the issue of him being alienated by Ms. Smith over this time. This was a pattern from start to finish to make sure that she was getting money from Mr. Hoffman's, but making sure that no one else knew that there was anything going on with them.
To the extent that suggests that the charity's fraudulent, shouldn't it have been addressed under a bad acts analysis as opposed to res geste?
And the issue with that is that Unfortunately, there is no federal tax law regarding these 501c3 charities that requires a certain percentage of money given to the thing that that charity actually stands for. So because there's no real requirement that we could say that Ms. Smith was supposed to give, say, 25% of this money donated to charities, we couldn't really call it a bad act because under federal law, she is actually entitled to do with that money what she wants to. But the important thing was that she was doing with that money what she wanted to, but not telling Connie or anyone else.
But the charity, the information about the charity or how they met.
Yes.
So they met through her charity. Pretty quickly after that, that relationship morphed completely outside of the charity. Do you agree with that?
I do not. And the reason why is because the most important thing to Connie and some of the things that he had testified to in prior depositions was sports charities and sports charities for children. He was a Division I athlete. He played football. That was his big thing. And so he really thought that Sophia was the person that she held herself out to be because of her purported interest in the thing that was most important to him.
You don't have to have a felony conviction or even a prosecution for other act evidence, right? Or for that statute to apply.
I'm sorry, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question.
So you seem to suggest that because she couldn't have been charged with a federal offense, that it was not appropriate to be brought in under the other act evidence statute.
In this particular case, we thought it most appropriate to come in under the res geste analysis, because it is another bad act of some type that we really cannot present this case without explaining that act. We didn't want to go so far as calling it a bad act, just part of a pattern of deception that she made. And that's why we tried to narrow.
Isn't that bad, though? I mean, you didn't introduce, the charity's introduced to
right.
cast her in a negative light, whether that's merited or not. It's introduced to cast her in a negative light. Right. She's not an honest person. This is not an honest charity.
And the statute actually doesn't say bad. It says other.
My apologies. It was other acts showing that her pattern of deception was used through this. And there was a limiting instruction designed to show that this was only to be used for the reason of showing that deception.
But that's propensity evidence.
My apologies, I believe I recited that wrong. The act of the charity was used to show that she was deceiving him from a number of different ways. The deception occurred from A, the relationship that she said that she was having, the what she was using the money for, the lack of any communication as to Connie as to the accountability for what she was using that money for, and A, telling him that she was taking some of these monies from the charity for the purpose that he was most interested in, but actually not doing that. And we couldn't, unfortunately, talk about why this charity existed in the first place and why she was getting him to believe her without discussing that charity. As far as, I'm sorry, the jury instruction, I think, was your second question?
No, it'd be great to address that too. Mine was on statute of limitations.
Oh, the statute of limitations, yes. So with count 7, I believe it was briefed that under any analysis, count 7 comes in. But with count 5, we go back to the secrecy issue. And the secrecy issue involving Ms. Smith is that everything that she was doing, the victim, Mr. Hoffman, was completely unaware of because he was being deceived. He had not any testamentary capacity to understand the nature of what she was doing.
In 2018?
In 2018.
You're saying he lacked testamentary capacity or was not competent in 2018?
At some point, I don't remember exactly when he lacked testamentary capacity, but he did at some point.
So
prior to that, however.
But count 5, though, is the purchase of a property in 2018.
Yes.
So Mr. Hoffman, to some extent, participated in that purchase. Right?
He did
there's agents, real estate, and there's a whole bunch of people in this. How is that in secret?
So the in secret part was what she had told him in order to get that loan in the first place. There was a long conversation that Ms. Smith and Mr. Hoffman's had about the purchase of this house, which Mr. Hoffman's entered into under the auspices that was what was actually happening. That was the reason for this purchase. That was never accurate. So that was part and parcel to her deception, again, that had started from the very beginning. So this The case really comes down to her initial deception and continuing deception about every reason that money was given to her from Mr. Hoffman's came under false pretenses. And regardless of when he did or didn't have testamentary capacity, the statute goes back to use of deception to deceive an older person. And so that's what we see over and over and over in these different crimes. As far as the testamentary capacity, that just made him a vulnerable person in addition to being an elderly person. We weren't required to show both of those things. Let's see. So as far as that goes, the count five, the committing in secret, at that time, no one else could have known what her actual intentions were for that property because she was making those she was making the opposite representations to the people that she was dealing with, the real estate agents, the salespeople, and so on. She was telling Connie one thing, and her purposes were something completely different.
So if we disagree with you on the in secret, you agree that count five is outside of the statute of limitations?
No, I agree that count five is within the statute of limitations because of the committed in secret issue.
I'm saying if we disagree on that point,
okay,
and that's how count five survives.
Yes, if we disagree on the committed in secret part. However, the record is fairly clear and robust as far as the misrepresentations made to Mr. Hoffman's by Ms. Smith, and that no one else in the community, no one including Mr. Hoffman's, was aware of her actual intent as to why she was getting that money. That's why we charged theft too. It was obtaining by material misrepresentation. And I'd like to also just briefly, if I could, address the prosecutorial misconduct issue regarding calling witnesses liars. In the Daniels case, there was a case that your court cited, I believe it was Overly, regarding this situation where the defense and the defendant's goal is to actually take the stand and directly contradict the testimony and call other testimony of other witnesses and evidence false. So in that case and in Overly, the court allowed the state to question and clarify, are you calling the other witnesses liars? Because that was the defendant's strategy in this case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, just briefly first to the res geste point. The limiting instruction here was specific in that the court directed the jury that they could only use the res geste evidence for the purposes of finding deception, which is an element of the offense. And so they could only use it for the purposes of actual guilt, which is just an incorrect limiting instruction under either res geste or bad acts. So the instruction was certainly problematic in this case in that it was for propensity. Additionally, Your Honor, as far as units of prosecution, the state is saying that 5099, which is the penalty statute, is part of their charging statute. That's incorrect. That's not what the language of 5099 states. It specifically states that you can aggregate for the purposes of imposing punishment. It is not anything to do with the charge. 5092 is the definition of exploitation. That is the actual criminal offense. Those are the essential elements. The state doesn't actually even have to allege an amount with the essential elements of 5092. So it's also problematic in this case because the state chose mixed and matched units of prosecution even within this very case. Count five is a single transaction, and all the other counts are courses of conduct over a year with really no indication as to when the course of conduct starts or stops, as you know this court has explained in Reimer and Senna, that when the abuse stops, that's a very clear demarcation that another count can come if it starts again. Additionally, Your Honor, the state's suggestion that 5099 creates prosecutorial discretion to mix and match units of prosecution is very problematic for a number of reasons. It doesn't put the defendant on notice on what they're actually facing or what the crime is that they've actually committed, and it usurps a legislative function. Units of prosecution have to be expressly delineated by the legislature, or if not, the nature of the crime indicates whether or not there is a specific unit or course of conduct that's appropriate here. As this court has, again, stated in Chu, where the unit is the person, Reimer, Senna. So if the prosecutor is allowed to do that, then it just usurps the entire legislative function of being able to legislate what the unit of prosecution is here. Your Honor, finally to the statute of limitations argument. I do agree with the court that I don't believe that count five was done in a secret manner, but even in a way that we look at the facts most favorable to the state, SWA James Burdett knew of the transfer of the condo and sought investigation for the money that Connie was giving to Ms. Smith on August 6, 2019. So even if the crime was committed in secret, at the very latest, Jim Burdett at SWA knew that there was some type of criminal element or something that was going on between Mr. Hoffman's and Ms. Smith, and therefore escalating it for the purposes of investigation. Additionally, count seven does fall outside of the statute of limitations because the statute, the NRS 171085, doesn't create a tolling. It doesn't create a tolling for the filing of the criminal complaint. They're two separate actions. That's been the court's jurisprudence for 50 years. They have no legal connection. So there's no filing. The filing of the criminal complaint in no way tolls the filing or the finding of the indictment. The indictment in this case was found outside of the statute of limitations, and that's the prosecution by which they chose to proceed. And because of that, both count five and count seven were inappropriately tried. Thank you.